I see that Irvin Witt is here, and we'll ask the appropriate staff person to be coming forward to talk about.
He just stepped through the door.
2704, and that would be Mr. Waters. He's a man in constant motion during the processes here leading to Senate Revenue Committee. Good morning, Mr. Waters. You're up, and with the bill is 2704, we'd like an orientation, and then we'll take some public testimony from Mr. Witt, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2704 is a revenue-neutral elimination of the Oregon marriage penalty. Beginning in the 2002 tax year. The way it does this is it increases the standard deduction for joint filers from $3,000 to $3,280. And simultaneously reduces the standard deduction from $1,800 to $1,640 for single filers, and then indexes these amounts for inflation beginning 2003. In 1998, of a total of about 1.6 million Oregon tax returns, about 45% of them were single filers and 55% joint. Of the single filers, about 75% took a standard deduction. That's about 550,000 tax filers. And of the joint filers, about 45% of them took a standard deduction. That amounts to about 400,000 total filers. We have a revenue impact statement which shows a small, slightly positive revenue impact. This simulation was designed, and the bill was tailored in the House Revenue Committee to be as close to revenue neutral as possible. It happens that it raises or appears to raise revenue by about $280,000 in 2003 biennium.
Thank you, Ms. Waters. Any question on the orientation? If not, Representative Witt. Good morning,
thank you,
sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the hearing today on the bill. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think Ed did an excellent job in terms of describing the measure. I would just add a couple brief comments. Number one, why this bill was offered. Today, there is a penalty for married taxpayers who file a joint return. For example, today, if you have two people that are living together and file a single return, separate returns, they get a total standard deduction of $3,600. They then get married and they file a joint return, their standard deduction drops to $3,000. They lose $600 in the standard deduction. As staff pointed out, roughly 50% of Oregon taxpayers use the standard deduction. So what this bill is designed to do is to eliminate that penalty that happens to folks when they get married and thus file joint returns. In the Revenue Committee, we discussed this, and it was the consensus of the committee that we would do this in a manner that was as revenue neutral as possible. So I worked with the Legislative Revenue Office and specifically with Mr. Waters on several different scenarios in terms of these numbers, and the closest that we could come to revenue neutral was the numbers that appear in the A engrossed version of the bill, which you have in front of you. The other thing that we did in this bill that, that Mr. Waters commented on is we indexed these numbers for inflation. In current statutes, they are not indexed for inflation, so the value of that standard deduction declines over time with inflation. Now that value will not drop over time with inflation, either for married taxpayers filing joint return or for single taxpayers. So again, we try to do this as revenue neutral as possible. The revenue estimate shows a slight revenue increase. If we had dropped the numbers a little bit less, you know, made the deductions a little bit larger, we would have had a revenue decrease. It was even bigger than the revenue increase in the estimate. So that's the reason for that. And of course, you can see now that the in the A engrossed version of the bill, that the married taxpayers get exactly twice the standard deduction as a single taxpayer would get when they use the standard deduction.
Representative Witt, do single people know where you live? I mean, is your address published?
Well, Mr. Chairman, actually, I don't think it is, but the potential tax increase here is about $14 or $15 if you're at the if all this income was at the 9% bracket. Of course, over time, that disappears because of the indexing. The tax break, of course, for the married couple here is correspondingly about twice of that, double that when they're using the standard deduction, about $30 roughly at the maximum. But to me, the important thing here is that it eliminates the current penalty or the current discriminatory treatment in the tax code for married taxpayers filing a joint return.
Questions? Senator Breyer?
Just a little technical question. Since, at least for some people, this is a tax increase, does this take a three-fifths?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it does not. We addressed that question on the House side, and this is not a net tax increase overall. As you can see, the revenue estimate shows potentially a slight revenue increase, but the answer is no.
So if the net is not, then it doesn't take a...
That's correct.
Okay. Further questions for Representative West?
Yeah.
Well, it certainly seems... Yes, Senator, please.
Thank you. If, in fact, using the information that Mr. Waters gave us regarding the numbers using the... standard deduction. By raising the married couples deduction, if this moved more of those folks into marriage or also utilizing the standard deduction instead of an itemized, would this not reduce the amount of tax revenue raised?
Let's see, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think what you're asking me is if people started using the standard deduction, married couples were more inclined to use the standard deduction instead of itemizing their deductions?
Right.
Might this increase the amount of revenue raised?
No, decrease.
Or decrease the amount of revenue raised? I guess potentially, Senator, that's true. I don't know that Mr. Waters took that into account in terms of looking at his revenue estimates. I think potentially that's true.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, Representative Witt, the simulation does show itemized deduction amounts for some of the taxpayers in the sample, and it does show at what point they would switch from being a itemized deduction filer to a standard deduction filer or vice versa. So some of that is taken into account to the extent we have the data.
Thank you.
Further questions for Representative Quist?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other person here present that wishes to offer public testimony on House Bill 2704? Hearing and seeing none, I will close the public session of the work session on House Bill 2704. I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move House Bill 2704 to the floor with a due pass.
House Bill 2704 has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions about the motion? Hearing and seeing none. Are there any objections to the motion? Senator Drake.
Yeah, we're going to take a vote on the bill.
We can do that.
Let's do that.
Let us have the roll call, please.
Boy, I don't know. I'll vote aye. Get it out of committee.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Who wants to carry this good bill to the floor? We'll have this bill be carried by Senator Starr to the floor. And we talked a lot about eliminating the marriage penalty. We talked a lot about equalization. It's one thing to talk about doing something. It's another thing to actually move it out of committee to the floor. I imagine we'll have a lively debate on this issue on the floor. I close the work session on House Bill 2704. Thank you, colleagues.
Notice that it wasn't a partisan vote in the House.
Actually, there was one no vote in the House. Not that we care what they do over there, but I noticed that Representative Corey was a no vote, and it was not a partisan vote in the passing of that bill in the House. I did not follow the debate on the floor, but I'll bet it was interesting. I imagine that we will be needing lots of hearing from a lot of single folks who have maybe an opinion or two about this bill. But thank you, Senator Starr, for volunteering to carry this good bill. Senate Bill 260 is up for committee today. Amendments are not prepared for our work today, so we will reschedule that one for a bit later for tomorrow. Thank you for tomorrow. So those of you that have come for 260, I apologize. This is the period of time when legislative council is both at their best and at their most hairy. So we'll revisit the issue tomorrow morning. Thank you. Senate Bill 935 is up, and I believe there are some amendments. And that bill is to be presented by Mr. Yates. At least the orientation. Good morning, sir.
Morning.
How are you today?
Very good.
Good.
Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. Senate Bill 935 does have a subsequent to business, labor, and economic development. The bill requires that agent compensation, we're dealing with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, agent compensation rates be determined by negotiation between OLCC and a negotiating team elected by current regions with urban, suburban, and rural representation. The negotiating team is required to meet every blank number of years in the bill. The rate at which the agents are compensated is indexed. The bill also prohibits minor decoy operations, not major, but just minor.
No punning allowed.
It creates a distilled liquor task force to study issues related to either eliminating the state monopoly on the sale of distilled liquor by bottles or to changes in the contracts between OLCC and the agents that will give the agents greater independence. Specifies membership of the committee and requires the task force report back. Now, this committee has already adopted the Dash 1 amendments. These increase the number of members on the task force from 9 to 11, adding representatives of the industry. The committee also adopted the Dash 2 amendments, which delete the minor decoy, the language relating to minor decoy operations. And this morning you have, in addition, a Dash 3 amendment before you, which sort of incorporates the Dash 1 and Dash 2, but so far as the Dash 1 are concerned, at least the language is different. So if you want to adopt the Dash 3s, we'll sort of have to reconsider the vote by which you adopted the Dash 1 amendments. In the Dash 3s, what you have, first of all, is a stating of what the percentage will be in terms of agent compensation, so that in line 10 of the bill, you insert, after ORS, essentially, the Oregon Liquor Control Agent Commission and any agent appointed by the commission under shall be 8.8% during the 2001-2003 biennium, and thereafter shall be established by negotiations conducted once every 3 years. So it fills in the blank and sets the rate of compensation for the first biennium.
Okay.
And then Section 2 remains as it is, and that would index that rate of compensation thereafter. Now, sort of, you should have another sheet in the materials, which is a table kind of, which I prepared, which just shows you how compensation is likely to vary under a given scenario there. I assumed, you know, a constant volume of output for a store of 100,000, I think. allowed that to increase 3% per year. So that would sort of give a liquor agent an automatic 3% increase in their income just from the increasing price of liquor. And then once you also index the compensation rate at the Portland CPI, then that's in the forecast, the March forecast. We haven't seen the May forecast yet, but in the March forecast, that's about a 2.8% increase per year. You add those together, and you're up to about a 6% increase in the compensation that would be going to the individual agents. Then, in addition, the Dash 3 amendments add some language. Line 22 of page 2, you're inserting there a subsection 3 after the existing subsections 1 and 2, which says the Oregon Liquor Control Commission shall enter into an agreement with the Health Division of the Department of Human Services for the performance of all duties of the commission relating to promotion of temperance in the use of consumption of distilled liquor. So the original bill sort of said, okay, OLCC is no longer going to have any role in the promotion of temperance. What the amendments are doing is continuing to give that responsibility to them, but directing them to direct to contract with the Health Division for the performance of those or activities related to those responsibilities.
Mr. Chairman.
Question?
With respect to that, is the Health Division commented on that responsibility?
As a matter of fact, Senator, they did. They were quite enthusiastic until advised that that was not their position. Okay. So I think they could do the job. They would be willing to do the job, but that was directed. Their testimony in support of that proposal was directed to be withdrawn. If that answers your question, sir.
Sort of.
So, Mr. Chair, are we spending a lot of time on a bill that's going to die?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I hope not. Here's my hope. There were some issues that needed to be dealt with from a constitutional perspective. One of those was that there's a constitutional requirement for the OLCC to conduct temperance activities. That is required. But there is no prohibition anywhere, if I may use that term, that says that they could not contract for those services from an agency that has a role in promoting healthy practices and lifestyles, which would be the Department of Health and Human Services. So we've asked that the line 13 of the proposed amendments indicate that the Health Division of the Department of Human Services would be an appropriate contractor for the delivery of those services. Yes.
May I ask, Mr. Chairman, maybe someone remembers their objection of, this is essentially coming from the agents, right? Their objection to having OLCC do that is that it's inconsistent with the regulatory function?
The consistent message that we've had from agents is that the functions of Oregon Liquor Control Commission in marketing and retailing and selling and packaging of alcoholic beverages for revenue for the state, and the promotion of temperance, which is their primary charge under the Constitution, are conflicted. And that if there was at least a different agency conducting the actual services of the promotion of temperance, that perhaps the agency would be better able to deal with their function, which is the control of alcoholic beverages and the services to customers and the marketing and retailing of spirits.
I'm sure, Mr. Chair, they must do something to temperance, but I'm at a loss for remembering ever seeing them involved in anything like that.
I think the idea is to make it as inconvenient as
yeah.
possible. that's the sole promotion of temperance.
Ah.
We see. So, that's where that,
to sort of continue that, that change, on line 39 of the bill, you have the addition of the language promote temperance, and the Dash 3 amendments remove that and substitute in place of it promote temperance in the use and consumption of distilled liquor on behalf of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission pursuant to the terms of the agreement required. Then let's see. In terms of the task force, you have the original members in the bill, and the dash one amendments added a representative from industry and a representative from OLCC, I think. And these use the same line numbers in terms of adding an E and an F to the language on page 3 of the bill in lines 10 through 13 there. It says that the members added is a member to represent law enforcement appointed by the president. I guess that's existing. A member to represent agencies that provide drug and alcohol counseling services appointed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives. So that the task force then is 11 members, but it's different than the one that was proposed in the dash 1 amendment. The last thing that the dash 3 amendments do then is to, in addition to the things that the task force is directed to address, it adds a final section there, E, which is such other issues as the governor, the president of the Senate, or the Speaker of the House of Representatives shall recommend, or as may be brought before the task force by the negotiating team provided for in Section 2 of the Act.
Thank you, Mr. Yates. Any questions about the proposed dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 935? Representative Byer.
One is, I guess I'm confused a little bit by, and it's a philosophical. I'm supportive of the notion of having a negotiating team. That makes sense to me, but why have a negotiating team if the compensation level is set in statute?
The theory there was that we would raise the agent's compensation rate over the next biennium, reflecting the trend in the industry. And I think that was information that was provided just this morning. Washington State just added 6% increase in compensation to their agents. And we thought that by the time we got back into the legislative session in 2003, the task force would have had an opportunity to meet, look at the effect of the CPI, look at the effect of the increase in population volume, an increase in revenue, and then make a decision whether to stay with the statutory formula or to modify that to reflect the negotiations by the negotiating team.
So the notion would be to put an automatic ratchet in law with the expectation that the legislature in the next or subsequent would change the law again if they thought it was too high?
Yeah, actually, the point was made that if you had a beginning point for negotiation, that the state would take a position and the agents would take a position, but at least they'd have a bracket to work with on. Question, Senator Minnis?
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with Senator Byer. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to put the rate in statute. There's no sunset in this bill, and there's no proposed sunset. So how do you guarantee that the next legislature is going to review the issue in the first place?
Good point, Senator. The idea was both to create a starting point and to foster a direct discussion, but a sunset would certainly require revisitation of the next legislative session. Was it your plan to propose a conceptual sunset?
Well, I mean, I can, I guess, defer to the chair. This is your bill and your judgment on this, but I would appreciate it, since there is a task force being created, that there be sunset language in it so that it's clear that the next legislature will have to revisit this. And I'm assuming then there'll be a report by that task force on what the recommendations are and perhaps legislation introduced.
And then the sunset would be reasonable at the 2003-2004, at the beginning of the next legislative session, or the end of the...
I assume July 1 of 2000.
Yeah, the chair would have no problem with adding sunset language. As a matter of fact, in my excitement to bring this bill before the committee with my amendments, I realized that I have actually put 13 members on an 11-member bargaining committee because it wasn't my intention to delete the dash one amendments. I thought the addition of the members from the wholesale industry was a good addition. But I remember being admonished by Mr. Lazenby about broadening the membership base of the recommendations and added the alcohol and drug treatment and the law enforcement component. So I still will have to reconcile how I get 13 roles in an 11-member committee.
So we're finding that Italian math is an awful lot like Irish math?
It can be. Can be.
Careful.
Senator Corcoran notices that for the record. Thanks for pointing that out, Senator Byers.
Yeah, thanks for a German pointing that out.
Excuse me. Senator Minnis.
Well, I don't know if this is helpful or not, but it seems to me that rather than having a member of the task force who's representing law enforcement, that you could include language that just simply says that this particular task force shall receive testimony from organizations representing law enforcement. There's a statewide sheriff's association, chiefs of police association, and others, and that directive, I think, would get the kind of input that you'd want from those organizations.
And the Mr. Yates, refresh my memory, the Dash 1 amendments added one or two members from the wholesale beverage industry.
They added two members. Let me get the exact language. A representative of an Oregon manufacturer of distilled liquor, and then a representative of an out-of-state manufacturer of distilled liquor.
They know a lot about law enforcement.
Is this part of our lobbyist employment bill?
Well, actually, I think it would be good to have the in-state manufacturers, because Oregon is a producing state, as you know, and out-of-state manufacturers tend to bring a little fresh air into the discussions about what's happening in national trends. So probably a good suggestion. It was not the chair's intention to delete it. I will have to either entertain another suggestion in committee or come up with another suggestion about the composition of the committee. I did think it was important to have somebody with drug and alcohol counseling experience to provide services, since that's, you know, a key element that seems to always be an afterthought in OLCC funding package. Senator Corcoran.
Well, Senator Menace and I figured that one compromise for trying to get it down in positions, instead of having both a law enforcement person and a lobbyist, just have somebody with an arrest record.
I won't assume that you're volunteering.
I'm not a lobbyist.
I heard they didn't return any of those indictments. So, anyway, the point was, it was not, what we need to do is reconcile the Dash 1 amendments with the Dash 3 amendments that we have. And I appreciate the suggestion about receiving testimony from law enforcement on the task force report and the sunset date. We are scheduled today for work session, but I see that there's other work yet to be done on this bill. What I'd like to do is ask if there's any persons here present that wish to offer testimony on the bill. And if there is, I'd like to have them come forward. If not, we will reschedule the bill for additional work session. Yes, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Distilled Spirits Council, and I appreciate the Chair's comments about trying to preserve the Dash 1 amendment. I just have one other comment about the Dash 3. Although this is a bill that really deals with one portion of OLCC's operations, that is the distilled liquor, the temperance issues that the agency deals with are, frankly, across different kinds of alcohol beverages. And our position at DISC is one that's supported by this state in many ways, also including its DMV manual, says alcohol is alcohol is alcohol. And frankly, the issue of promoting a temperance should be across alcohol beverages. So that would suggest that perhaps on line 16 of the Dash 3 amendments, the term distilled liquor be deleted and alcoholic beverages be inserted instead, and also on line 19. I think the issues of temperance and, frankly, some of the concerns about temperance are even greater with other beverages than ours, although we all have that same issue to address.
I appreciate your comments. The question I guess I have is, when discussing this issue, we were all trying to think of the efforts that the OLCC uses to promote temperance with non-distilled spirits, beer and wine, and nobody could think of any. And we were just wondering, maybe as the representative of the Distilled Spirits Council, you could help us in the direction, what And I know that's probably not a question that you should be answering, you should be asking the agency, but I'm not aware of the efforts of OLCC to promote temperature beer and wine consumption.
Mr. Chairman, I am not either aware of any. That doesn't mean that there aren't any. I just may not be aware of them. The Department of Human Services does, in their alcohol and drug abuse and health programs, deal with these issues along with other health issues. And I expect that the primary efforts, and I'm going a little bit on a limb because I'm not completely sure I know all of them, I expect the primary efforts are already in those health-related agencies.
Well, I guess this comes under the heading of the willing suspension of disbelief, and because, you know, we could do that. That minor change won't matter, I believe, and it may, in fact, if not changed, cause some confusion about the temperance mission. Thank you very much.
Questions? Mr. Chair, they could consult with Budweiser Corporation. They seem to be pretty good at promotion.
Promotion, yes.
Very good.
Because horses don't drink any beer.
The good news, Mr. Chair, is that Mr. Cosgrove didn't come in and recommend an automatic ratchet in wholesale prices.
Oh, he did.
I didn't mean to mislead the committee to that direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other persons here present that wish to offer testimony on the bill? Yes. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. John Steubenvall, Communications Director with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. To the previous question, Mr. Chair, I believe OLCC does do a number of activities in regard to temperance of alcoholic beverages. We have a number of pieces of material, a number of literature pieces that address the temperance issue. In addition, the training classes offered and approved by OLCC include heavy pieces that include how to teach bartenders and other sellers of alcohol how to identify visibly intoxicated people and not provide any further alcohol to those individuals. I believe that's temperance by any other name. The other piece I'd like to address here, Mr. Chair, is in the proposed -3 amendments, where the 8.8% compensation figure is used for the coming biennium, I think we would ask for some further guidance from the committee on this specific point. The overall agent's compensation level as set by the Ways and Means Committee for the coming biennium is 8.54% of projected sales for the coming biennium. So I guess I'm not sure how we reconcile the 8.54% as authorized by the Ways and Means Committee versus the 8.8% that's called for in the -3 amendments. So I think we would then ask for some further guidance from this committee as to how we get there.
Yeah, I think obviously what happens is if this finds favor with the committees, then it goes to on a subsequent referral to the business committee, business, labor, and economics. But obviously the co-chairs of Ways and Means would have to be advised of a potential change in the revenue picture based on that. And the question is, based on projected increase in sales, what does that mean in the revenue picture in the biennium? Senator Byer?
Mr. Chair, I guess that was a question. Was subsequent, why business economists rather than Ways and Means and maybe both?
The referral was requested, I think, when the bill was assigned. I requested this referral. So I believe it had everything to do with the idea of the recognition that the Business, Labor, and Economic Committee had an interest in this bill equal to the revenue that's produced for the revenue plan. So this bill could have been assigned to that committee and heard and then subsequently referred to Ways and Means.
I suspect the question's a good one. It probably needs to find its way down to Ways and Means.
Yeah, I agree. And the co-chairs will be made aware.
And Mr. Chair, if I might point out one more little detail. In Section 2 of the bill as written, talks about the negotiating team of agents. Again, we would ask for some further guidance from this committee or from the legislature on this point, because as currently structured, again, the overall agents' compensation fund is set each biennium by the Ways and Means Committee and then by the legislature. So under that system, OLCC would not have the authority to negotiate directly with the agents to set a compensation level. So in effect, those negotiations would be advisory in nature and would have to then come before the Ways and Means and the full legislative body for, in effect, ratification of those advisory negotiations. So,
yeah, actually, there's a couple of interesting pieces of information that would apparently conflict, but I think they are reconcilable. One is that there are negotiations between the agents and the agency, and your testimony would lead people to believe that there are, in fact, no negotiations since that compensation level set by the legislature. What we're advised is that there are, in fact, negotiations between individual agents and the agency as to the size and the scope of their operations, and that leads to some adjustments in the compensation package for those agents. Agents have argued that there is no practical negotiations precisely because Ways and Means sets the amount. And I guess that is an issue that it's overdue for consideration by the legislative body, whether or not that's an effective system, whether it really reflects a negotiation between the agents and the agency, or whether that is just what we choose to call the a statutorily set compensation package that we've been working under for about the last 50 years. Senator Beyer?
Mr. Chair, you hit it. I'm just curious. Fortunately, I don't have to deal with this.
I thought you were going to declare a conflict there.
Under the current system, the legislature sets the overall compensation level. How does the OLCC negotiate or arrange contracts within that overall?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's set on a formula based on sales, essentially size of the given liquor store based on sales. We have six types of what we call exclusive liquor stores. Those are stores that sell distilled spirits and no other type of product. And those stores, based on their sales, are given a base rate of compensation each month, and then a percentage of, on top of the base, a percentage based on the sales for that given month. And I'd be happy to provide materials to the committee. And Mr. Chair, if I might go back to my previous point, I raised the previous point about the negotiation team precisely given the aggregate amount of the agent's compensation fund set by the Ways and Means Committee and the legislative body as a whole, because the way I read the current language in the bill, that's specifically what would be addressed by the negotiation team. And therefore, I think it's important to put on the record that we have a hard time getting to anything aside from an advisory role for that negotiation team that would then be brought back to the Ways and Means Committee and the full Legislative Assembly.
Thank you, and I think that is accurately stated. The fact is that many of our agencies do deliver their budgetary presentations. We do regularly hold back funds in Ways and Means. There's an active negotiations process, advice and consent, if you will, from the agency to the Legislative Emergency Board for the release of those funds and through the Ways and Means process. So it is a process that we're familiar with. I think what it does is offers a different venue for discussion compensation, which really has not been open. The agents don't have access to the Ways and Means process. The agency does. This actually gives the agents more of a voice in helping to set compensation, even though the agency will be the message carrier that goes back to Ways and Means. Thanks. Further questions? Hearing and seeing none, obviously there are some further amendments that need to be brought to this bill, and the chair will undertake those and hopefully bring the bill back before we end up writing off into the sunset. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 935. Colleagues, we have before us House Bill 2207. We have the appropriate staff person for orientation.
Back again.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2207, A. Again, this was the Department of Revenue bill that was brought to you, I think it was Monday this week, we heard this, and it allows an appeal of a penalty for failing to file a real combined or personal property tax return to the tax court if the property has been omitted. So this was kind of clarifying some things that were changed last session and just trying to make sure it's clear in law exactly what Department of Revenue is to do. And then it also is allowing an additional taxes to be paid prior to the completion of a following year's property tax roll. It also provides a discount for the additional taxes that are paid early. And then you also heard about an A2 amendment, which is going to be allowing the Department of Revenue to receive funds from the county assessment funding assistance account to pay for those appraisal expenses of principal industrial properties. Right now, it's just secondary industrial properties. So it's principal industrial properties and property of centrally assessed utilities companies, and this begins 2001-02 tax year. And so the revenue aspect of this is minimal just due to the slight reduction there would be from having appeals of these penalties.
Okay. And since we've already heard this on 5-7, then our action today is for the work session, so we'll open the work session on House Bill 2207.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move the A2 amendments to House Bill 2207.
The A2 amendments to House Bill 2207 are moved. Are there questions? Other objections to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair.
The House Bill 2207, as amended to the floor, to be passed.
The motion is to move House Bill 2207 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any questions on the motion? Objections to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Need a volunteer to carry this good bill. Vice Chair volunteers. So ordered. Close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2207. I guess it was just a work session. Great. We have left on our agenda, colleagues, House Bill 2670.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, this House Bill 2670A, this was the bill was brought by Representative Morgan to deal with a constituent issue, the Myrtle Creek Golf Course. And so again, this creates a property tax exemption for those nonprofit corporation who leases land from the municipality and then uses the land both as a golf course and for the discharge of wastewater. And allows any unpaid property taxes and interest to be waived beginning after July 1st, 1998. And then the property tax exemption is going for 25 years. It goes out to year 2021. The application must be filed with the county assessor for that tax exemption. Then again, this is a local option. You have to have the local ordinances passed by all those local districts in order to receive the property tax exemption. And it begins for... The application period is just until July 1st of 2002. So due to the narrow window of opportunity in which they can apply for this exemption and due to the nature of it being a nonprofit corporation that is leasing the land for the golf course from a municipality, all those particular criteria is needed. It should only affect Myrtle Creek in Douglas County and have a revenue impact of approximately $7,542 each year in the future, and beginning in 2002-03, it's $40,886. And I know Senator Corcoran had mentioned about the city of Prineville, and I had called them prior to this, because there was a work group and stuff we worked all on this bill, and the city of Prineville already exempts their golf course if it's owned by a municipality.
Did they talk about the waterfowl on the golf course?
The foul water?
Waterfowl. This was waterfowl attracted to foul water. So go ahead, Myrtle Creek. At your own risk, baby.
Well, let's not talk about the Oregon garden season. Okay. These are very creative uses of water, wastewater treatment facilities to produce an additional benefit for the community. Local issue, local control. Let's open the work session on House Bill 2670. Thank you for the orientation.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Moved. House Bill 2670, A and Gross, to the floor. Go to due pass.
The motion is to move House Bill 2670 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections to the motion?
Senator Menasoff's talking to carry the bill.
Actually, yeah.
Oh, you weren't paying attention?
Cemeteries and sewage.
Actually, we do have a lame duck on the committee, but actually the chair will carry the bill and spare the unfortunate references to law enforcement continuously and irritatingly brought by Senator Corcoran.
You didn't say anything about donuts today. I haven't said anything about donuts all week.
Which I appreciate. All right, so there are no objections to the motion. So ordered, then the House Bill 2670 will move to the floor of the DuPass. Recommendation the chair will carry. Colleagues, I appreciate your help. Mr. Vice Chair, I appreciate you having the public hearing on the 5-7, which brought us to the point of being able to move some of these bills. Thanks very much. Other questions? Colleagues, in front of you there is the May 8th memo that talks about our schedule for next week. Monday, 5-14, revenue forecast day. We will have a group of folks here. The Joint Ways and Means Committee will be here, seated. This will be an interesting engineering challenge for this.
How are we going to do that?
Room 50. Room 50. Oh, okay, room 50. Okay. All right.
Room 50 on
so
Monday.
Theater seating in room 50. Bring your ticket. That will also include the
House Revenue
Committee, the Senate Revenue Committee, the Full Ways and Means Committee, and any of the sub-chairs would like to attend. Revenue forecast will be presented at 8 in the morning, and we will...
8 o'clock on room.
At 9, excuse me. Thank you.
Other than the room and the time, is there any other part of this that you want to get wrong?
I know it's on Monday.
That's correct here.
And then Tuesday, we have no meeting with the Revenue Committee, and that is to get to offer an opportunity for chairs, co-chairs, and others who will ultimately be thinking and trying to reconcile the information we get from that Revenue Committee report with their own agendas and important bills, large ticket budget items that are left on the agenda. So no meeting Tuesday. We'll be back Wednesday and Thursday, and the committee has the memo to look at the House bills that we have to move before us. So no meeting Friday as usual, and that...
And you think by Wednesday we're going to know everything after we thought about it all day Tuesday? That's what you're thinking, Mr. Chair?
Actually, Senator Corcoran, what I know is that that is sort of the opening music for the final minuet that brings us to the close of the legislative session. So whether or not the corporate kicker kicks will be known. The size of the revenue projections for the biennium. At least we're going to be dealing with numbers that will be indicative of what we have for the biennium. And that, I think, starts the real negotiation process on school funding, the dollars that are available for from the cigarette tax settlement, payment or non-payment or date of payment to the retirees of dollars obligated, just a whole panoply of budget and revenue issues. So that also, if you recall, we have passed out of this committee many of the tax cuts, credits, and others that have been waiting for the revenue projection to be reconciled into the final budget. So those things will also be in play. And no, Senator Corcoran, obviously it's going to take more than a day.
Dang.
Dang. Colleagues, thank you very much. I appreciate your indulgence this morning on 260 and 935. We are in adjournment until tomorrow morning.